This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. Right now, I get to turn to Chad Boudreau. He is an author who has written a book called Scavenger Hunt. You know, many people know where they were on 9/11, and I think Chad knows exactly where he was the night before 9/11. Hi, Chad.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Wow. So it's true that you were hired on the day before 9/11?
That's right. That's right. I was waiting patiently, or maybe not so patiently, for months after interviewing with the Department of Justice. And the night before the terrorist attacks, I was sitting in my study in Austin, Texas, and got the call. Probably, I think, 9 o'clock Central Time, so 10 o'clock Eastern Time, obviously. And the next morning, I woke up to drive into work at my law practice, and that's when I learned of the terrible events of that day.
Whoa! So you were just shoved right into what happened, and of course, with your situation, you're working now for the Department of Justice at one of the most critical times in the history of the United States.
It really was. I mean, I was 27 years old at the time. I had been married for a couple of years. Only had a great Dane, although he was big. He's the only real character in my book, Judge. And we packed all of our things and dumped them off at some barn in East Texas and drove all the way to D.C. and ended up in a very small condominium not far from the Supreme Court. Where the world had changed, and our world certainly had changed, and it was a very harrowing experience, to be sure.
So you arrived, the Pentagon had been hit, and it must have been really a startling thing to drive into Washington, D.C. a few days after this happened.
No doubt. I mean, I had been a political science major in college. And by the way, I tell my kids now, do not get a political science degree unless you have to, because I don't think I've ever used that before. But apologies to any political science professors out there. I've tried to use mine. But I did have wide eyes when it came to D.C. I was mesmerized by it and loved the energy there. But, we were third in East Capitol, which, again, is like a stone's throw from the Capitol itself. The FBI had created a semi-permanent barricade right there in front of our condominium. And it was just every morning you woke up, and there was an energy, there was a little bit of frightfulness, really like an esprit de corps with the city, though, when it came to, this mentality of, we're not going to let this happen again. But, Patsy, I'll tell you one thing that was very interesting, and that is, not too long after 9/11, the fear around the Capitol wasn't really focused on international terrorism or any other kind of terrorism other than the snipers, the D.C. snipers. And I don't know if you recall those two men who were driving around and just randomly committing violence, deadly violence. And I remember walking outside my condominium door and so I could get the Washington Post because you just never knew. That was probably the most frightful time during that period.
So there you are in the Justice Department dealing with, immediately we're looking at terrorism and what we can do to stop it and what's happening in the country, because we didn't know if there were other terrorists around.
No doubt. Every week it seemed like there was another story in the paper. And I know that the week I started, the week that I showed up on site at Main Justice, there were reports of anthrax being through the vent, the mail room and through the vents. And so we had to evacuate. The Congress had to evacuate for anthrax scares. It seems like every week there was something new. It was not only preventing future attacks, but it was also addressing victims of the attacks, those who had survived, and family members who had died. My first day on the job was sitting down with those folks and talking about a victims' compensation fund, which ultimately Kenneth Feinberg helped administer and did a fantastic job. And now is a special series on Netflix and called Worth, where Michael Keaton plays Mr. Feinberg. And that was a lot of our time spent soon after I got there.
Now you've written this book, which is based on your experience in Washington, starting, of course, during this time. And you have a main character, Blake Hudson, and as you said, he does have your dog. you brought your dog into the story.
Yeah, and it's funny because Judge's favorite place to hang out was right around the Library of Congress, so it's a little ironic. And I feel like we've memorialized him well. So I'll let the readers figure out what happens to Judge, but he is somewhat of an important character in the book.
Well, he definitely is. Let's talk a little bit about Blake Hudson and what's going to happen to him. How does he get dragged into all of the events that you're writing about in the book?
Yeah, so Blake is a character that evolved over the writing of the book. And I say that because what I wanted to do was I wanted to take, and to the extent that there was I'm probably giving this more intentionality than there was at the time, but I wanted to create a character that was somewhat of an amalgamation of a lot of the other folks that I worked with. And he's got a lot of different characteristics that you would see from people working in an apartment. And he also has kind of a neophyte sense to him because he's new and he's young and he's in a position of a lot of power. And that's not uncommon in D.C. to see this. And what I did with Blake is I created a very complicated and treacherous situation, about as treacherous as you could think of, and I put him in that scene, in that theater, and we kind of watch, see how he responds. And he's just a young lawyer that has done pretty well so far, and he just wants to do right by his country and for his job. And we make that very hard for him to do. to watch him get out of that box is all about the narrative.
Explain the scavenger hunt, or the title.
Yeah, so the scavenger hunt, really it's about going after the terrorists at the very sense of the word, but then they being the scavengers. But then you find that there are some hidden henchmen behind the scenes that are driving things, and ultimately the hunt is, Blake becomes he's no longer the hunter, he's the hunted, and is running for his life, and you're trying to figure out who's after him. So that's really the basis behind the title.
For you, when you were there, it's Washington, as you said, is such an exciting place, and there is so much happening, and of course, there are all these different aspects of who's doing what and why are they doing it, and who you can trust very much. So I think in Washington, because people are confused at this point when it happened. Oh, great. Listen to that. Here I am, the host, and I left my phone on. Well, maybe that was a secret message. You never know. and that could
shut you down.
That could be true. Maybe I hit a nerve to somebody. I'm saying that they have secrets in Washington, D.C. It's always so funny. I mean, now, you do have in Washington all the time where you have a scene where the people are talking and you don't know who's listening. And of course, nowadays, they're all listening.
It does feel that way. I'm not sure. We're having a conversation recently just about the Patriot Act and how the politics behind the Patriot Act has evolved over time. And but there is this sense now with all of the technology, whether you're in D.C. or not, people feel like, their conversations are no longer private. Now, for me, that's okay because I don't really talk about that much important. But I know for others, it's can be very disturbing to even think about that. I want to go back to what you said about D.C., though, and it's really a place sometimes where it is hard to trust those around you. I think those of us that have lived there, we certainly have our groups of people that, you know, whom we trust, but it's, you kind of see human depravity on stage sometimes when people are put into that political environment and everybody's competing for power. And in D.C., as you know, it's interesting in Texas, you know, people are always trying to have the biggest house or make the most money. And when you get to D.C., everybody kind of has the same size house, but it's about who has the most power. And so it's a little bit of a different dynamic for me when I moved up there to see what drove people's incentives and things and behaviors.
And who has the best secrets. And, of course, for poor Blake Hudson, some people think he's paranoid. He's saying, people are watching me, people are following me. But he wasn't paranoid.
Well, you know what they say, you know, even though you may be paranoid doesn't mean you're wrong. And in Blake's case, that's certainly true. And he had a lot of things coming at him at one time, and things started not to make sense. And for good reason, it turns out. And so the fun of the book is really about watching him and see how he addresses those challenges with attention.
And of course, it's very relevant because you have different aspects: China, Pakistan, Iran. It's all real. I mean, we have all these enemies.
Yeah, I think too. You know, what I'd hoped to do. Somebody asked me, you know, last week about the book. They said, "What were you trying to say other than the story?" And I said, "Well, the story first and foremost is entertainment and." The reader needs to be captivated from page one to the end, or I've failed. And I don't really have any political agenda for this book, but if there is one thing that I think is a subtle undercurrent, and maybe it's not so subtle, is I think Blake Hudson exposes the challenges that we have with all of the things going on in this world. And what you find is, whether you're more leaning towards privacy or more leaning towards national security, some of us fall on that spectrum somewhere. And but oftentimes the pundits and the politicos try to make that a binary situation. You either have to do this or that. And it's not that easy. And I think that Blake in his plight exposes that. It's really not that easy. And so by putting him in these harrowing situations, including all these different countries, I think you get a sense of really what we're up against and how hard it can be to maneuver through the maze.
Well, and it's true. I mean, we really, I like when a book has this underpinning where we have, we're talking about real problems. You have the story, but you have also this, hopefully people will take a few minutes and say, yeah, is this happening? Is China doing this? Is Iran doing this? So it opens people's minds, and I think that's a very important part of a book like this.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I think that it is going to educate many in kind of the different situations. I think those that are in the space, whether they're diplomats or they're other parts of the legal or national security apparatus, they're going to understand kind of what these challenges are. But for the casual reader who just wants to pick up a good book and learn about new characters and get lost for a little while, I think you do come away with this book of, like, digesting some truths that we have to confront. And I hope I've done that in a way where, you know, liberals and conservatives will both be happy at times and unhappy at times about how the characters act, because that's normally the way it works in the real world.
And the situation in this world today, what we're facing, all of these challenges of trying to understand, you know, we are in many ways playing checkers when they're playing chess, because they have these countries have long-term goals. They see far into the future. What's happening today isn't as important to them as what is going to happen years from now. I think as Americans, we don't think that way.
You couldn't have said that better. I really think that we're obviously blessed to be in a country that is, you know, a constitutional republic where democracy is real and underpins pretty much all that we have in our judicial system, at least, in our political system. But China doesn't have that. As much as we love our freedoms and we don't want to give them up, they do provide restrictions, and the restrictions are not restrictions that China and others who really think about hegemony over the world, and their history shows that that's their aim, that's not restrictions they have. And you're right. They do have a very long-term game plan, and you can kind of see, even if you're paying attention, see how they're working throughout the world right now to carry that out.
Well, anyone who's ever lived in Iran, and I did live in Iran, most people, you know, are not aware of the difference, really. Although we've gone through the Iraq War and we had all of this, they still don't understand the concept of Shiite and Sunni. They still don't understand they really, each side has a long-term, I mean, they're looking 100 years from now of becoming the dominant power. And it's hard for us to, as Americans, to think that way. We just can't conceive that people can have this long-term game plan and work just zealously to get to that point.
Yeah, it's hard to get that perspective. You're right. I mean, there's many good books that, you know, your readers, or your listeners rather, who care about the issue just mentioned could turn to. I remember reading A History of the Arab Peoples back in the day, and just really getting a better understanding of the Sunni-Shiite conflict, and you do need to kind of understand their perspective if you're going to address the challenges and opportunities
exactly
that we have as a country.
And meanwhile, Blake Hudson has a lot of challenges in both his work world, which is not always easy, because he has to deal with a lot of outside of the world, you know, politics, but inside, just office kind of politics that he has to deal with people.
Well, and he's also a single 20-something young lawyer who actually has a love interest too, and so he's got that to deal with. But yeah, the office politics are acute, and really, I think, you know, I looking back on the book, and particularly the dialogue in the book, I think most of the rich dialogue comes between the banter in the office, and that was of all the many fun times I had writing certain parts of the book. That was a highlight for me, is kind of reliving some of those conversations that I had as a lawyer there at Main Justice. And those aren't my conversations, and those aren't my people, but, you know, it's reminiscent of what I saw. Actually, spent some time at DOJ. We spent a lot of time going up to New York for obvious reasons after 9/11, and that was a focal point. But my main travel happened when I moved to be the Deputy Chief of Staff for the Department of Homeland Security right after that. And we flew to a lot of really interesting places and met very interesting people. And of all the travel that I did, that's probably been the highlight, actually, not only of my career, but also just of my life, really.
And, of course, you've drawn a lot of that into the book. I'm glad you mentioned dialogue, because you do write really great dialogue.
Well, I appreciate that. As a trial lawyer, I think my passion growing up, as a young lawyer, was trial work, and as litigators and trial lawyers, I think we watch people very closely and we listen very intently, because, you know, when we have a case, whether we're on the plaintiff's side or the defense side, on the prosecution side or the defense side, we know that a lot of times we're going to have one very powerful judge, or maybe three on the appellate side, but really 12 jurors, and they come from all different walks of life. And they look different than one another, and they have different experiences. And if you don't know kind of what's on their mind, you're going to lose. And so I think just paying attention to what people say, you learn dialogue, and you learn a dialogue that's real.
Well, I think you had fun writing this book. Just quickly, you know, my listeners are always interested in what books formed you? What books had the greatest impact, books that you read?
So I think from a pure intelligence and spy kind of novel side, it was Robert Ludlum. Robert Ludlum, for sure. I also grew up a Tom Clancy fan. I don't have his detail, but I like the way he told stories. Interestingly enough, the characters that I hope to build, the character development, I learned a lot from Stephen King. And I really liked his book on writing as a guide. And again, you heard me mention it earlier, but one of the things that I used to roll my eyes at when I read on writing was he said, your characters are going to change and surprise you, and they're going to take on lives of their own. And I was kind of thinking, that's hokey, you know, pie in the sky kind of archy stuff. But then when I started writing, that actually happened. And the outlines that I would do, I'd do kind of a skeletal outline to begin. My character started turning the outline on its head, and so I'm a true believer now in that concept.
Well, that's why I call this show Joy on Paper, because it is such a joy when you're writing, when at one point the characters start taking over, and it is so much fun.
Yeah, and then you start getting mad at your characters, and they take on lives of their own. I just had that happen a few weeks ago. I'm mad at my new protagonist.
I was going to say.
That tells you what kind of, tells you what kind of shape I'm in.
Well, I was going to say, of course, this is your first book, right?
Yeah.
Your first one.
Yeah.
And I knew, of course, the minute I finished it, I said, well, he's already writing the second book. I mean, he's just found that joy on paper. So I knew that you were not going to stop, right?
We're going to keep going.
Yeah.
And until someone tells us to stop.
Well,
we've got one in the editor right now, and then I've researched a new one over the break, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
That's what I love. That's what I love when writers find that joy on paper. It grabs you, and then the readers find that joy on paper when they read your book. So it's all together. It's a lot of fun, and I think you've done a great job with this book, and I hope that people will get it. And your name is Chad Boudreau. I love that. And the name of the book is Scavenger Hunt. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
I do. I do. It's just chadboudreau.com.
Okay.
So Chad Boudreau.
Yes, spelled beautifully the French way. And it is When Justice is Blind, Scavengers Do the Hunting. And Chad, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you. And as soon as you have the next release date, you'll be back here, right?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that, and definitely we'll be back.
Okay. Keep writing. Have a lot of fun. And, yeah, it's nice to argue with your characters. Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
He's cute. Isn't he cute? Bye-bye now.